Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Lindsay Rowntree, I'm head of content at ExchangeWire, and I'm joined by Kieran O'Kane, CEO of ExchangeWire.
Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, Kieran.
How are you?
I'm really good. Well, so, you've annoyed me, so I'm not that good at the moment.
I was late because I had lunch.
You were late because you went and met someone and didn't tell me.
I did. I accidentally met them. It was really
accidentally
weird.
Met them.
I can't tell you what happened on air because it's quite me too-y.
Oh.
Yeah.
No.
I had my ass pinched.
You had your ass pinched.
Yeah. It was Martin Kelly.
Awful.
From Infectious.
Have you? Oh, no.
Yeah.
I see. So it was accidental.
No,
you didn't plan to meet you.
A violation.
Oh, well, not the ass pinching.
In the
obviously.
Brazilian chickens.
Oh, Jesus
queue.
Christ. Okay. Right. Anyway.
Okay.
I'm going to introduce our special guest now.
Okay. Good.
We have Ryan Afshar, who is co-founder and commercial director at Inadvia. Hello,
Hello,
Ryan.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Doing well. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thanks for having me.
If you haven't heard of Inadvia, you'll find out a lot more about what they're doing later. But in the meantime, let's kick off with the old news stories, shall we?
Dun, dun, dun.
Drum roll.
Should we have a little theme tune for that?
Do you think we should actually introduce sound effects into the podcast?
Kind of like a, you know, like printing presses or something like that. You know, like.
Sure, yeah.
Those old things called newspapers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are those?
Who knows?
Yeah, quite. Anyway, first story is about your favourite person, Kieran, who you said you would work for.
Yeah.
Sir Marty.
Sir Marty!
But never call him Sir Marty because he hates that.
SMS.
So S4 Capital is buying US digital agency Firewood. So they're expanding digital capabilities by acquiring Silicon Valley-based agency for $150 million. This agency has several high-profile clients, including Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, and Salesforce. This will add significantly to S4 Capital's headcount, and they're going to be merging Firewood with MediaMonks. And this falls in line with Sir Martin's stated growth plans of S4 Capital growing rapidly over the next 18 months and the focus on digital and programmatic. And he's stated that the reason they're merging MediaMonks and Firewood is because he does not want to create the fragmentation that the likes of WPP had. So he wants to make sure that he has one content arm and one digital arm and not create different offshoots and branches everywhere because it just makes things more confusing. So, I mean, it feels like the next stage of his kind of acquisition trail is he's still looking for a company that can give him first-party data. Now that I think is a very interesting thing, but the money he's got to do that probably isn't a huge amount, so it begs the question, who out there could he be buying? I mean, there's tons of questions here. What do you think about, first of all, him buying a US-based digital agency? A lot of his activity so far has not been US-based. Actually, it's been very Europe-based and very APAC-based, so that says something in and of itself. And also, kind of, where do we think that S4 Capital will be going next? Kieran, let's kick off with you.
So he more or less predicted this at ATS London. If you actually look back at the interview, which we haven't published yet, it's coming soon.
It is coming in the next
he
couple
actually
of weeks.
talks about this. You can actually see the fact that he took a US business and he talked about the US still being the market to be in, the scalability, the money, the marketing spend there. He just seemed to allude the fact that he wants to be in there. So this him purchasing a similar company. I don't know. Is it Firewood?
Firewood.
Is it a similar business to MediaMonks or is it an execution layer? Because there's a lot of talk on different sort of message boards that it's a Google first shop. I don't know enough about the business. I didn't read enough.
No, from what I can tell, it's an execution layer.
Oh, it's an execution layer.
Yeah,
so it's a bit
tell.
Similar to Mighty Hive ish. So, I mean, it's no surprise that he looked at the US. He did say something interesting in the ATS London sit down with me that he didn't see S4 Capital buying a first party data asset because he felt that the regulatory heat around that and what we described it, he's the butler layer, so he wants to be, you know, working with the Googles, Amazon,
the butler,
Facebook.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we discussed this in the office, right? Like the whole first party thing, and we've looked at a lot of the holding companies go after first party data.
But where is it?
Exactly. And the fact that he did say on stage or alluded to it that he wouldn't be going down the same route. But he has told, this is a Reuters article, he has told Reuters he's still looking to acquire companies that own first party data on consumer habits, but said he had two small deals looming for data analytics companies with one in London and one in Korea, which will slot into the programmatic offer.
There's one company I know he's after, I won't say it on air, but
boring.
Be very expensive compared to what he's paying here. He's slowly building a very, very interesting proposition. He's obviously got a clear definition of what he wants, and he wants to get to a billion dollar, £1 billion mark cap, which you'll probably get there within, you know, 12 months. The stock has gone off from zero. It's gone from zero to 600 million in the space of what? 12 months. So he's got a plan in place. He'll keep adding to that. But, you know, maybe he is right. There is not many scale first party data assets. And I did an article this week about why I think brands will buy publishers, because actually when you go fast forward 12 months ahead, with all the ITP and GDPR and CCPA stuff floating around the place, it makes a ton of sense for brands to start looking at verticalized publishers with logins, or utility, if you will, utility publishers, to go after them, because these guys will have a ton of first-party data.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe that's where he should be looking. But
the
then
whole Under Armour.
Yeah,
Under Armour buying MyFitnessPal.
That's the key. I remember Nathan Woodman. Remember Nathan? He was at OpenWeb and now was at Havas Media in the US. Super, super smart guy. Always, I feel like, three or four moves of everybody else. And he was pinging me on LinkedIn yesterday going, number seven, do you remember that? And I said, I remember that, because he actually was the one who talked about Under Armour and how he thought that
he was saying
more
this back.
FMCG brands would buy first data. Like, you know,
he said this back in 2016. Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
Well,
Ryan.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I heard he was in the market for an in-flight programmatic. There's a lot of first-party data
there. That was a very early push there, Ryan. Very early push.
Wow. No, but I think, you know, the model that he's kind of replicating is the consulting model, right? He's kind of, you know, the Accentures and the Deloittes are kind of where they're not really interesting. You know, they're kind of, the WPP approach was kind of, our agencies will integrate into the tech partners and you kind of work with our agencies. Whereas he's kind of, you know, he's all about in-housing. Well, he may not come out and say that. I know that he kind of alluded to it at ATS, but, you know, where the brands have the data and they'll look after, they'll appoint the tech partners and S4 will essentially do all the integrations for them, right? So yeah. I suppose it's, you know, is it another, you know, I don't know if we name names, but, you know, like a Jellyfish or something like that, would that help that kind of... Or is it more just pure first party data that he's looking for?
But he seems to be putting his eggs in the Google basket. Like, a lot of these companies are based on the Google. We were discussing this as well. Like, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen next with Google, but they are actively locking down their ecosystem at the ADH, the advertising data hub. Is that what they call it? The cloud infrastructure they're building around.
I actually don't remember.
I don't remember if it's ADH, but yeah, but they are making a big bet on that. So, you know, as a executor, it makes a ton of sense for him to kind of bet all on Google, because they still have access to YouTube, like, unique access to YouTube, and then their Google universe will probably be locked down as well. But can he get any bigger? Like, it's interesting he's building this capability. Like, how big can this get? Like, you know?
Well, I think one interesting point that Ryan, you and I were talking about before we started the podcast is he talks about not wanting to create a fragmented selection of companies that are different branches going off different things. Now, the beauty of the holding company, and WPP do it, every other holding company does it, is using it to be able to manage conflict of interest. So there are a finite number of verticals you can work with.
Yeah, yeah.
So the beauty of having multiple companies that do the same thing effectively
is
it means you can have different
firewalls.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So him saying he wants to remove fragmentation, how will that impact his ability to be able to get clients? Is something I'm considering.
Yeah. Maybe he feels that there would be enough disparity globally, like, you know, because he's hired some really, really good people. If you look at the people he's got working from, like, a lot of the alumni from Group M and WPP and Zaxis have moved across, and they've with their acquisitions they've got some really, really good people working for them as well. So, you know, he's put a premium on talent, but also he's kind of clear about the model he wants now. Like, you know, it is an interesting proposition, but as you say, Lindsay, the agencies set up those separate agencies within the holding group so they could do BA and Virgin and different sort of ends of the jungle. Like, but that clearly isn't coming into his mindset right now with that.
No.
You said about the reliance on Google, or at least, you know, the key as being a key partner, and that's kind of, you know, he's obviously come full circle from his opinions on the walled gardens to now at S4. But, you know, we've seen what happens to publishers and the over reliance to some of these big walled gardens. Like, could there be too much reliance on Google, and could that backfire, do you think?
Well, in the short term, no. Maybe long term, yes. I mean, it's hard to know what Google's going to do next with their stack. I mean, there's ongoing conversation between Google and the TCF, you know, the ability for independent ad tech to work with Google. But my sense is Google will play along with this for a while and then just basically pull the privacy trigger. And then, to be honest with you, why would you not go all in with Google? Because of their just breadth and strength within the digital ad ecosystem. Like, look at YouTube, man. It's an absolute beast. It's the biggest CTV platform in the world. $25 billion. It's revenue per annum, and it is still the only scaled digital video outlet you can go to. Like, you know, so it's hard to disagree with his thinking around Google.
Yeah, short-term. And he's certainly not alone either.
He's not the only one.
In putting all his eggs in the Google basket.
I mean, WPP are doing the same. All the holding groups are making a bet on that as well. You know, it's hard to know how that's going to pan out, though.
Yeah. And do you think, I mean, obviously you said you have an idea of who he should buy next, but don't think he'd be able to
and it's about, if afford you look it. At, if you look at consumer first-party data, there's a couple of businesses out there, but they're not really ad tech businesses. They're more sort of like aligned to this industry, but they're not quite in this industry. So it's a tricky one. Where do you get first party data? Like, you look at Epsilon, that acquisition by Publicis. Epsilon are just basically repping third party data. When the CCPA stuff comes along with the California privacy law, it's gonna be very difficult to use that without opting in users. Like, it's gonna get very messy. And those type of assets, unless you have that direct relationship with the user, it's very, very hard. Look at Under Armour buying MyFitnessPal. MyFitnessPal have a direct relationship with those users. We log in, we use the app. Under Armour then uses that to kind of either do, you know, user acquisition or retention, one or the other, like, you know.
That's a great chance to save on a unprofitable publisher as well.
Oh, Lindsay, I think this is going to be a huge trend. I could just see particularly vertical publishers who have really good data set in the like Mumsnet is a good example of they've got a massive message board which has lots of logged in users. That would be a good buy for someone like Boots who wanted to sort of like take on the Mums market, right? Mumsnet wouldn't be enough to cover off the UK, but you could certainly see them buying a bunch of blogs and bringing that together and letting it operate as an independent entity, so they can it's almost like a live CRM, if you know what I mean. Like, just keep it going, invest in it, you know, don't let it wither and die and just kind of strip mine it for its data and then, like, you know, abuse it. Just let it sit as an independent, but it's still your CRM, it's extended CRM. I see more of this happening, because where is this data going to come from? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I guess, and then the watch point of any brand doing that and buying a publisher is making sure that they are not then exerting the brand's values onto that publisher and keeping it very, very independent. Because there have been examples in the past where a brand, I think it was a kind of a well-known youthful publisher that was quite, you know, it used bad language, it was, you know, but it was very, very popular, bought by T-Mobile, and then T-Mobile bought it and it became completely sanitized,
right?
And then they lost all the users, all the data, because no one wanted to use it anymore. So there's an argument there. You have to be very, very careful about what you buy and then how you maintain it.
It's a tricky one, particularly for an M&A department within a big FMCG brand, right? You also have to have a new mindset and see, almost have a church and state sort of approach, right? So if sort of you can think Mumsnet and Boots being the two examples I use, right? What if somebody on Mumsnet bar started mouthing off about Boots' products, right? Does Boots close that conversation right then? Or is it an opportunity for Boots to address that problem in a public forum, right? Really, really, those are the type of nuances that you have to get around. But it feels to me, as we move more and more into this privacy first era, and I don't care what anybody says, we are definitely moving from a third-party economy, ad economy, to a first-party. Publishers become very, very, very valuable. And brands are going to go, whoa, am I going to pay, you know, Google and Facebook all these extortionate amount of money over the next couple of years? Because invariably, eCPMs will rise as soon as the long tail supply becomes a constraint, right? Or even like programmatic supply. Where are you going to spend your money? Oh, I'll spend more on Facebook. But then there's more demand for inventory in Facebook, so the eCPMs rise. And then you're just kind of like, you're wedded to Facebook in that respect. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, next story.
We got kind of diverged there.
You often do that, so it's no surprise to either of us that you've done that, frankly.
I apologise.
Yeah, I don't think you really mean it, but that's fine. Anyway, the next story is one that's caused many a reaction, many a comment from people. It is the news that Taboola is buying Outbrain. for $250 million in cash plus equity stake. Now, there's lots to be said here. Kind of, some people feel like it's sort of two stars colliding and creating, like imploding and creating a black hole. It's a very, very interesting move. Some think it's a genius move. Some are very, very unsure as to what that then means for the future of publishing and the future of monetization. Ryan, let's come to you and find out what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I suppose with two big players coming together, there's always going to be a fear that it's, you know, the about price, right? Whether it's the control comes back. Is publishers going to have any point of negotiation? They've only got one place where they can go to. But again, I suppose it comes down to what's the sort of trading method with these publishers. I've heard that, you know, some of these, the Taboola and Outbrain, they've gone into long-term commercial agreements with some of these publishers. So that may not make an initial kind of any difference.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. So
MRGs to publishers must have been hitting their revenue. Like, you know, Outbrain and Taboola are paying publishers a guaranteed CPM versus the CPC they get from the click-throughs. I'd love to see the economics behind this, but it means that you've basically wound up the entire content recommendation market, like, you know. So it's probably a good move for both of them.
But them coming together, that does that make them the one viable solution outside of the walled gardens? You know, for example, you know, Adam Singolder, Taboola, they've already been trying to create the alternative to Google and Facebook and Apple by launching Taboola News. Do you think them bringing Outbrain to the fold as well, because they're both similarly sized companies, both valued at around $1 billion. Mm. So it's not like one is kind of engulfing the other. They're actually two big entities coming together to be run by Adam Singolder. Will this create something viable in size to the walled gardens?
From a publisher perspective or from an advertiser perspective?
Both. Publisher certainly.
Yeah.
I guess, as you said, Ryan, it probably won't make any difference, certainly in the short term or even the medium term. But actually, is it another form of monetization that publishers are able to tap into that's even bigger and more scalable than what they currently have? Or will it make them more wary to work with them? And then from the advertiser perspective, how will they work with the new Taboola forward?
Taboola.
Outbrain.
Yeah.
Taboo brain. That's right.
Taboo brain.
I don't like that.
That's a good one. Taboo brain.
Anyway, there you go. Go ahead. Have that for free.
No, I just think I suppose the advertiser perspective, you know, I don't know enough about how many, you know, big brands use these platforms. It's, you know, is it publishers are effectively the advertisers as well for using them for traffic driving?
It's a lot of publishers,
you know, isn't
it?
And the kind of models, you know, I don't know if they have big trading agreements with the agency. So whether that's going to be a big impact, because, you know, it's going to be more for affiliates, I guess. It's an opportunity for to kind of.
They have, if you look at the advertisers on the actual, like, let's be honest, the Moon and Outbrains, the content recommendations aren't great. Like, they you know, they're like long tail, sexual clickbait, if you will.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you never guess what she was doing next, and then, like, you go to this 15 slide thing expecting to see something, but you're not seeing anything, you know what I mean? Not that I advocate that type of thing, but that's what they're trying to do. There's almost like an arbitrage opportunity for most of their clients. I rarely see any really brand advertisers on it. I'd see publishers using it. Like, if you're a publisher, like The Guardian, well, The Guardian's not a good example, but Telegraph or something like that, who sold a sort of like a branded sort of content thing at a high CPM, and they're just driving traffic towards that specific sort of thing. So their margin on it is great. They're not just driving traffic to arb the display traffic on their own site. They've got massive CPMs and they're just driving traffic. I see a lot of that, but I never see really any brand.
No.
You know, you never see like any really brand.
There are, though. There are.
Well,
the way they use them is slightly different, so you wouldn't necessarily know it was the brand advertising when you're doing it, because again, it's because the way that you would use the Taboola and Outbrains of the world would still be very much content led.
Yeah,
so you might go to a kind of content subdomain rather than the actual brand, like to go and, you know, like complete a lead or fill in a form there and then. But there are brands that do invest in it as a kind of easy
PPI brands.
Form of, well, there are plenty of those. Yeah,
yeah, but like we talk about brands, not FMCGs. Like, there's, it's,
well, no, but then there are more brands out there than FMCGs.
Yeah, yeah.
But outcomes based lead generation brands, they do use it.
I think they're like, I think that opportunity is mid to long tail. All right, it's a small, it's a basically it's a click based opportunity. It's an AdWords opportunity, right? In many ways, it's like, you know, they're paying a CPM, but they're backing into a CPC, right? So if they can figure out a way to get like more Dior advertisers getting to use it, I think there's a huge opportunity for sure. And maybe it will scale and let them lock down the market. But, you know, will there be more competitors coming in to compete with what they do? Maybe. I don't know.
Will they expand upon what they do? Will they go beyond just being the content recommendation engine that you know and love? Or maybe not love.
I don't know who you are. I mean, the we spoke about the Taboola News app before, and it hasn't really come to fruition.
It's not on handsets that we really have in this market, though.
Well, I haven't seen any stats about it or any pieces about it, so I'm not really sure if they're PO-ing or is it still in beta. But, you know, stuff like Update have done very, very well here in Europe, and, you know, Apple News is obviously, killing it on the sort of on news recommendation thing. So maybe there's an opportunity for it to expand beyond that, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how...
What about starting to compete with maybe the likes of Teads on Outstream or in those kinds of areas? Ryan, well, like, where do you think they can go next?
But it's below the fold. It's kind of like, you know, they're not high-impact placements that Teads, you know, are famous for or you know, the Unruh.
It's not in an article, is it? It's more the bottom of the page.
The bottom of the page. It's kind of... I mean, look, publishers need that revenue. I just question when any of these, like, you know, when Yahoo and Microsoft ads came together under the predecessor of Verizon, Oath, was it? You know, it doesn't necessarily equate to bigger market share. It just means that advertisers are going to spend, you know, a certain kind of proportion of their budget with that kind of entity. And I suppose with this, it's, I don't think they're just them coming together is going to mean they're going to increase their revenues. I think it's a portion of certain marketers will put their ads into these kind of, like, if you call them native ads or, you know, whatever you call them. But
the question you've got to ask yourself as well, they're giving publishers a lot of money, right? But at what price, right? If you think that the Telegraph has sold a really premium sort of like page takeover for like an airline, right, high end, and the user's going, wow, that's pretty impressive creative, like, you know, that's an instant brand recollection 4 months in line when buying tickets, scroll down to the bottom of the page and there's your Taboola and Outbrain, you know, clickbait, you know. So is there an element of it's taking down the sort of the premium aspect of the site? And as we move more and more into this premium sort of first sort of environment, because a lot of these publishers are going to start seeing traffic decrease and ECPMs rise, right? So the quality of page has to be better. And it actually means that, you know, the other thing that I think publishers are going to start looking at, is it better for me to keep these people on my site or click away, right? What's the value for me as a publisher and for my revenue, right? If you're clicking away Outbrain and Taboola's main sort of objective is to click people away because that's how they make money. Will publishers start rolling back saying, well, I want to keep user on page? And when they look at solutions to improve,
well, they'll look at the plus and minuses of each, like what's the revenue of trying to keep them on page and keep them and get them looking at different articles versus what's the revenue that they get from
Taboola
if I send them off somewhere else.
So
it's probably a fine line. Frankly,
there is a fine line. I think bigger publishers are starting to think about it. I know they maybe saying, okay, they're writing us a big check, but maybe going forward, is it better to increase page views? Increase the yield in my own stuff rather than clicking away, traffic, valuable traffic.
But it could be clicking away to other publishers within the portfolio of that publisher, right?
Yeah, very true.
It's keeping it within their, you know, they've got multiple titles. You look at TI Media.
Yeah, but they don't make it, like, Ryan, the reality is Taboola and Outbrain don't make any money by keeping people on the page of the, let's be honest, the product's free, right? The only way they make money is to charge a click.
But that's what Ryan's saying, though. They will click onto another site, but that site could actually be in the same portfolio as the publisher they just came on.
But so why is the publisher paying? But the publisher doesn't. Could easily put that link on their own page.
No, then they've got more. Then they can. It could be a lower quality site that has more. They can shove more ads onto. It could be a subdomain from a kind of more important kind of one of their main premium sites.
But we talk about the same publisher has another site and they're clicking away. Well, why do you need to build an Outbrain to do that?
Because how else would you get someone there?
Well, you could set up your own tool. Like
you can, I mean, you would, but or is you that, can it's use much easier. But it's easier couple lines of code, isn't it?
Yeah, it's catching their attention, especially if you've got a publisher that has multiple verticals. You know, you're on a sports site and actually you want to drive, you know, you want to keep them within or send them to a home and beauty kind of publication. There's a way to do that. Rather than having it on the tool, you know, the top bar where, you know, if you're a sports vertical, you don't want to be advertising that necessarily at the top.
Yeah, but I, this is where it all goes pear-shaped, right? If I'm in a sports vertical and I'm reading a sports article, I'm more likely to want to if I'm reading an article about Irish rugby, right? I'm going to start the next article I'm going to read about is how does Ireland get to a semi-final in the World Cup? Probably it's going to be impossible to do that, but what's the strategy, right? That's the article. I don't care about home. This is where it all gets a bit tricky, right? And this is where I think the model falls down. It's the publisher starts thinking about, okay, I'm losing traffic versus getting £5 CPM. But because these two companies are coming together, I can see a downward pressure on the eCPMs they get from those things. And that's probably the biggest fear for publishers. So if I'm to take the devil's advocate view of this, I think it's great for both companies because they've basically just locked down the entire market. Does it give publishers more scale or advertisers more scale? Probably. But are advertisers really buying into this stuff? I don't know. And maybe they need to do more trading deals with the agencies. That in itself costs money because of rebates involved in that process. Well, nobody wants to talk about rebates, but that's the truth. So, you know, it's got its pros and cons. But for the two companies themselves, I think it's a good move.
Will they IPO?
Not in the current climate, no. I thought they might. But next year, I don't know. I mean, after what's happened at the minute with WeWork and a few other companies, it might not be a good time to IPO yet.
No.
Maybe what they... Well, we know there's at least one outstream company on the market. maybe they'll come together, raise some debt, start buying other ad tech companies and adding more value to what they're doing. Like, outstream seems like a logical move for them to go into. So imagine if they could own that real estate plus the bottom of the page, that would add real value for them. But then they're locking down more of the publisher's revenue. So, you know... It's a pros.
I feel like I recommended that earlier. I said that earlier and you shot it down. So
about the outstream?
The outstream, yeah.
Yeah, but so, I think you just have...
So now you decided 3 years later.
I didn't.
Now it's your own idea.
No, I didn't take your idea.
When I said it, it was a stupid idea.
That's an outrageous statement.
Well, I feel like that's what kind of happened.
I don't think it happened. I just remembered that one company was in the market and just put two together, got a five. Jesus. All right, Gary Lineker. Gold hanger there. Right, let's move on.
So Netflix is banning... let's start again. Disney is banning Netflix ads across its properties in an effort to compete directly with other streaming providers. It's launching Disney Plus in the US very, very soon, I think in the next few weeks. So initially it was thought that Disney would ban all competing streaming providers from advertising on its properties, including the likes of Amazon. I mean, Disney already owns Hulu, so it doesn't count.
Right.
But actually it's managed to work out a deal with everybody else, just not Netflix, banning them completely. So it's an interesting move because obviously Disney has removed all of its content off of Netflix. And other channels as well.
Yeah.
It's not allowing any other channels to license Disney content anymore. So it's going all in on the sub model. Now, what do we think about, first of all, Disney has basically created a streaming war. Do we think it's the right thing, banning Netflix and being able to advertise? It was estimated that 15% of Netflix's revenue advertising spend was going on Disney properties.
Was it?
Yeah.
15%?
Of its advertising budget, yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's... But they haven't banned... They're not planning to ban Amazon Prime ads or Apple ads, right?
No, they've worked something out with them, apparently.
Well, isn't it? It's a coincidence. That's clearly got to be around retail and kind of the opportunity for those other two platforms to help monetize or help sell other Disney products, right? Because Netflix can't do that for...
That's a very good point.
If you block Prime advertising, suddenly Amazon going to pull down... Or, you know, if they get into that kind of war, they're going to pull off all their products. Or equally, will Apple stop selling, you know, the downloads of Disney films? I don't know. Because I can't see why you wouldn't do...
But Disney's pulling all the content off the rival platforms.
Yeah,
but they're also blocking the ads from Netflix.
People to advertise on its properties. But it is allowing Amazon and Apple to do so. They've worked out an agreement by which Amazon and Apple can do that. And actually, Ryan makes an interesting point. Amazon sells a lot of Disney products. Outside of TV, outside of streaming,
dolls
what about? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What if the agreement is related to that somehow? because it could be an Apple with the kind of the transactional products as well, not just the subscription models.
This is getting interesting, hey. I mean, 12 months ago, this wasn't even a thing, right? When Bob Iger, and Bob Iger is probably the finest CEO around at the minute. Like he announced that he was going to go all in on the streaming piece with Disney. Stock market reacted very badly to it, but then as he got into his stride and explained the process, and obviously with the Netflix growth, he's managed to convince the market that he needs some leeway. And Disney's going to create, like, probably as big a business as Netflix. Maybe not as big, but it certainly is a must-have. We think about the streaming channels you have right now, right? You know, you've got the Netflixes and Amazon, but Amazon Prime is rolling to that. Some of us would have Now TV, which is kind of Sky Atlantic, and access to sports when we want to, which is a handy thing. And then there's probably room for maybe one more. And let's be honest, Disney's going to have Marvel, it's going to have Scott, it's going to have all the Star Wars stuff, it's going to have backstories to both of those franchises. They're going to have all the films, all the kids' stuff. So, like, as a family, or even just, you know, a single person or whatever, you kind of would buy into that, because it's going to be an interesting media package. Now, it's interesting that why Netflix Disney would ban Netflix ads. It just feels a little bit. Just feels like we've taken shit off you. Now we're going to kick you while they're down, sort of thing. Because maybe Disney rightly sees Netflix as their true competitive entity globally
in one area, right? And that's the thing is, for example, if you're going to have that attitude to identifying who are your competitors, then you have to kind of do it across all areas. Like, for example, Google. There's a lot of, I know that there's a lot of Disney, be it Maker Studios, content that sits on YouTube. I remember a couple of years ago when there was a big RFP for Disney as a broadcaster, their tech stack, and they gave it all to Google. And so, there's this whole argument of as a broadcaster, you're competing with Google in many fronts because they're taking your ad dollars. And so, but you go and give the ad tech business to them. So it's what do you choose as your battleground? Is it can't just be streaming.
Do you think maybe it's personal? Because I'm just having to think.
Is there more hidden under the hood here that we don't
have
access
to? I think maybe Reed and Hastings and Iger maybe have some beef. It's interesting. I'm just having to think about this. You had Zuckerberg, kind of railing against TikTok and said, we're going to be TikTok. And TikTok spent $1 billion, I think, last year on Facebook just to get people to download their app. So why didn't Facebook ban TikTok when it has more of an existential risk to their business than, Netflix Disney has, and or vice versa, Netflix has and Disney, I think the Netflix and Disney are going to be complementary. I don't think you take one or the other.
I don't think you'd have one, not the other.
I think Netflix are doing some really interesting stuff, and they're building for the general taste as opposed to Disney, which is going to rely heavily on its franchises. Yeah. It's not a very creative company. That's an unfair thing to say. But it's bought a lot of those franchises. It bought Marvel, but it manages them very well, right? It uses the Disney powerhouse. And Pixar, they bought these assets, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a big cat. But they're not a company that creates unique content.
No, they can't compete. I don't think they're going to be able to compete with the investment that's coming from Netflix and Prime into content.
Original
content. Also
contents.
Local content. These streaming platforms, I think, isn't it 30% of it has to be local?
Yeah.
Is Disney going to do that? I don't know. Certainly not.
I don't see how it can.
No.
I see a lot of, my algorithm, Netflix algorithm, is messed up.
You watch some weird shit.
I actually watched a Chinese show there, a subtitled show, and now all I'm seeing now is Chinese shows in my feed. and I'm going, this is weird. But I couldn't really, I just went through them. There is a ton of them. It was interesting. Korean, Indonesia. I was like, wow, there's some good stuff here. I mean, it's really, some of that stuff is really good. But it's interesting that you say international. Netflix seems to be like an absolute powerhouse now in production and talent acquisition. It just seems to be unstoppable in many ways. Like if Disney tried to compete with Netflix, it would get burnt, man, badly.
Netflix does very, very well in having access to back catalogues from the likes of Disney and related broadcasters.
Yeah.
So with it losing some of these like historic shows that people just love to kind of come in and binge every now and then and kind of rewatch a million times over, like it losing Friends recently, that was a big thing because that was actually one of the most watched things on Netflix. will it be able to? Is original content enough for Netflix to be able to maintain its kind of how far ahead it is at the moment?
I'd like to see the list. You know, the Friends thing maybe can be overblown. Maybe there is big numbers watching it, but really, people are not buying Netflix for Friends. They're buying it for original content. Let's be honest here.
I don't think they are. They are. I think you are not the population.
I'm
bored of having this argument with you every day.
I don't agree with that. I don't think there's a lot of bad press about the population being stupid. I don't believe that.
That's bad press. No, I did not say that. Only you.
I didn't say that. Like, these people watch Axe Factor, but they're also pretty intelligent people at the same time.
Right, okay.
I think you're right, Lindsay. But, you know, but at the same time, they needed the back catalogue to get the customers, for the customer acquisition at the start. Now it's become much more appointment to view, isn't it? It's the new series that's coming out of Stranger Things. You know, look at what they're doing. They're competing theatrical now.
And they have their own back catalogue, actually.
The Irishman, no pun intended, but that's coming
Make
out.
Make as
that's,
many puns as you like about him.
that's a Netflix movie that's going straight to theatre. And it's got, you know, the cast of that is unbelievable.
Yeah. Did it go to the theatre? I thought it was going straight to Netflix.
No, it's going straight to cinema. But it's,
right. But it's not.
And eventually will end up on Netflix. But
it was going to be Netflix first. What's the whole point of it?
No.
Okay. Weird.
But yeah, I suppose their ad model is you know, if you think they need to, is it enough to? I don't think they're going to launch an ad model, but I think if you look at product placement, it's got to be huge for Netflix now.
15 you know? Million they made out of, apparently they made 15 million in product placements on Stranger Things without really pushing the dial. And as
it wasn't really pushed. It was really subtle.
Yeah, really subtle. But as technology, this is where ad tech, believe it or not, comes into play again, right? It's the monetization of media. Yeah. As ad tech figures the way to build the ability to kind of like dynamically insert stuff in those programs, it's going to get really interesting very quickly. Maybe they don't need ads because like there was we've talked about this before on the podcast. There was a brilliant little scene in Stranger Things about regular Coke versus Cherry Coke.
There was, It was just really
clever. The two kids are like going about, what do you like about Cherry Coke? I was going, oh yeah, I remember that. And they go, I see what they're doing there. I don't like it.
Yeah.
But I do. There could be more of that going on.
There was a joke this season about that they've brought a new flavour in. Have you tried the new flavour of Coke yet? When they famously decided to try and change the recipe of Coke and completely screwed it up.
Yeah.
There was a nod to that this season, so maybe they're trying to backtrack on it slightly.
Yeah.
But I mean, particularly kind of the ad insertion thing, particularly relevant when it comes to things like cartoons as well, because Netflix do have a lot of their own original content cartoons, like BoJack Horseman's a good example. Actually being able to dynamically insert ads into that kind of scenario wouldn't be too challenging to do, really.
Yeah, or you know, what companies like Myriad are doing, which are like kind of inserting, overlaying creative within, you know, billboards that are in the movie or in the content or any other kind of like format. They're able to do that, and they're moving to do that dynamically and even programmatically. So
it's funny that companies like Myriad who kind of were, you know, they were kind of in the background for a while, they're come to their age now, because like we're now in an age where streaming is like people just binge, and like I don't know what your viewing habits, but I watch a lot of streaming, so it makes a ton of sense that to get someone like, you know, that audience and captivate them, or catch them in that sort of mode, and you need new technology to do that. And companies like Myriad are kind of moving in that direction. It's quite interesting, actually.
Definitely, that's probably a good segue to talk about other companies that are moving, that are becoming, you know, of their time.
Yeah.
Ryan, in Advia, what does Advia do?
Well, I suppose the easiest way to describe us: we're an SSP. We're the first SSP dedicated or purpose built for in-flight, in-transit advertising. And that's ads appearing within, you know, your in-flight entertainment systems, which historically have largely been seatback or embedded seatback systems, but with that only represents about 10% of all of in-flight entertainment aircraft that have in-flight entertainment.
Really?
The other only 10% of aircraft have a seat embedded in-flight entertainment system, which is, you know, a lot of people find that really. I certainly did when I found that out. And so the other 90% of aircraft have no in-flight entertainment. And
you think about the short haul flights, though. Most people are flying short haul,
narrow bodied aircraft, single aisle.
Yeah,
because of weight restrictions, you can't actually put the technology into seat. But also, as we all know, that technology is obsolete within a couple of years anyway. So the huge cost to kind of upgrade, it doesn't make any sense. So now the technology exists for bring your own device streaming, to direct to device streaming of content in a closed network within the cabin. And so, you know, with the growth of that and the players that are coming, the vendors that are coming to provide that technology to airlines, there's an opportunity for an addressable advertising solution. And so that's what we do. That's what Navia does.
So how does that work from your perspective as the SSP? So I've got my own device on a flight.
Yep.
How are you then able to serve me ads based knowing I'm on that flight? Is it, am I connected to something on the flight? Is it, is there a way of me accessing entertainment on that flight that I wouldn't otherwise have access to? Like, how does that actually work?
So to sort of give you, so you board the flight as you would, you know, depending on the airline. Most, it used to be very app based, but now it's all moving to browser based. You don't have to preload any app. It's a closed network, so it's just like going onto an intranet. But it allows for 100% capacity streaming to your device. And so these are the systems that, so it's not, it doesn't require, it's not Wi-Fi. So there's a distinction to be made around connectivity versus content. So it's a, it allows for 100% capacity of the aircraft to stream that content. And the UI or the interface is just like a seatback system. So you'll have a choice of movies, you know, flight path, perhaps some shopping or gaming. And, you know, so then we serve the ads into the, into that. So it's not real time because obviously when the flight takes off, it's a disconnected environment. So a bit like, you know, if you look at what happens with broadcast, the VOD or digital out of home. So the trade, the programmatic trade will happen up front before the flight takes off. The targeting criteria will also be uploaded into the onboard server. Mm. And then once that user is identified in the air, when it's disconnected, the ad gets served. And then once the flight's finished, it lands, and then all the data, metadata gets passed back to us as the SSP and then onto the DSP.
What I love about this, though, is it's a truly programmatic channel, right? But in this privacy-first era, think about it this way. Even if you're using a Safari browser or a Chrome browser, all the ads can be served first-party, right? The auction can take place based on some data from either the user login or sort of like just general sort of flight path. We're going to New York. This is a business flight. This is a consumer flight. So there's a huge opportunity. One of the things that always attracted me to this company was the fact that that this segment of the market was never addressable, right? And it's in-market travelers. Like, so was it 4 billion people travel on flights every year? 4 billion. That's impressive.
Every year, which is set to double over the next sort of 20 years. But a nice little stat is that at any given time, there's 1.3 million people in the air.
That's terrifying.
which is equivalent to the size of Estonia, actually, in terms of population. So it's a huge. I mean, we had an event yesterday which talks a lot about, you know, the audience, the growth of this audience in the sky and how to reach them. And, you know, as Kieran said, you know, it's the kind of final. People talk about addressable TV or digital out of home as the final frontier for programmatic, and actually in flight is probably a couple of years behind that. So what we're doing is allowing that data capture that's, because of its bring your own device, there's a login there to use that data. Yeah. Not only, you know, look at the context, but as Kieran said, which is the flight or destination, which can be really compelling for an advertiser in addition to, you know, your normal targeting criteria. And as it moves forward, is then there's the opportunity to start to look at, you know, other more detailed data like age, gender, demographic, and maybe even, you know, purchase data once we get into the kind of flight in the actual airline data. So, you know, the opportunity is huge, and I think, you know, it's a 100% brand safe environment. You know, if you look at the scarcity of video today, of premium video, and how hard it is to get that kind of brand safe, 100% viewable environment, this ticks all those boxes. It's pre-roll video, it's 100% video, there's unique data,
privacy forced.
So, you know, let Sam Martin know where we are.
As that's who he should be acquiring next.
You just get shares in Advia. S4 Capital.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you look at what he's looking for, it does tick the boxes. So, you know, I'll leave it for him to decide. No, it's it's exciting.
It is exciting. And so how is the audience changing, and how are you, I mean, how long you've been going? A couple of years? Like, what?
3 years now, yeah.
3 years.
Yeah.
And how are you seeing, I guess, the model change and the audience change? Because I'm guessing initially it wasn't around bring your own device, but probably more around kind of the devices that were already fitted onto the planes, for example.
Yeah,
you're
right.
How is that actually changing?
So yeah, so the actually there was an article in Bloomberg came out yesterday about talking exactly about this, which is the future of the seatback system, or the lack of, and moving it to all bring your own device. And you know, you raise a good point, because that 10% of aircraft that still has, it's still a large number of passengers viewing premium content. And what's happening with those systems is that they're being upgraded now to allow that addressability. So we work with both sources of inventory. At the moment, most of that is seatback system, because that's the legacy systems that, you know, the partners we work with, like Panasonic Avionics, for example, who make up about 80% of all the aircraft has a Panasonic system. But now the software upgrades allow for that addressability. So you can do the sort of audience targeting and run the programmatic campaign on that. And then as bring your own device increases over the next 3 to 5 years, that will largely be the bulk of the inventory, the video inventory we have, which is much more data enabled and with first party data. And you know, the engagement levels are huge.
Interesting. What about other transit, like trains?
Yes, as I said, you know, we are kind of a platform for in-transit media. The technology, the same streaming technology, is rolled out across all transport types, so trains, coaches, also maritime. But in-flight is kind of what people know, we're more familiar with. And actually, it's, let's face it, from an advertising perspective, it's kind of very sexy in terms of, you know, the appeal for to target in-travel users, because the in an aircraft, you are engaged. You're in a very different mindset. You're not on your morning commute. You are kind of either on holiday, or even if you're on a work trip, you're still more relaxed. And so more receptive. And if you can get that, you know, the classic right time, right place, right person, right message, and the message being the key thing here, because we see that, just like the way that audio, mobile, social has now created, designed, bespoke for that context, we're seeing that, you know, advertisers really want to design their own creative for the specific context of in-flight.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
There's an interesting one as well. The destinations are quite interesting, because, like, if you think about luxury, I think luxury is like the sort of segment that gets, it's hard to advertise because the supply constraints are so, you know, they're there. So if you think about flights from, you know, Saudi Arabia or the Middle East, or from Russia or from Chinese, high spending, you know, network people, particularly in business, you know, that's a real big opportunity for a travel brand to really hammer that home and sort of do a lot of branding there. So there's huge opportunity there, I'd say, on the sort of different segments.
Well, there's a lot you can tell, isn't there, by a destination someone's going to, and even the day of the week and the time of day they're going. Actually,
absolutely,
there's probably a lot more contextually you can understand on that versus them looking at a website.
Yeah. And, you know, that context is absolutely right. And you know, targeting ads based on that information is one of the things we talk a lot to advertisers about. But also, you know, we also talk about this sort of, you know, the breaking it down to its lowest common denominator, which is this is pre-roll video that's data enabled, that's brand safe, it's 100% viewable by its nature. And so it makes a great extension to sort of TV campaigns or digital campaigns where, let's face it, you know, 85% of video is sound off. You know, and that's really a reaction to the fact that there is just not enough premium supply out there.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that there's now Cannes Lions category for best silent ad, you know, speaks volumes in terms
I
of like...
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so, it doesn't speak volumes.
It doesn't speak volumes. Doesn't speak volumes.
Very good.
But yeah.
Oh, dear.
So I think, you know, we're excited about where this is going, and actually we want to get more advertisers interested in this as a medium, because it's now more it's just like the argument for addressable TV, you know, isn't it? You know, Sky, I think Sky AdSmart's seen, you know, 75% of advertisers that are on Sky AdSmart are new to TV and new to Sky, and that's because there's less wastage, they can really target those audiences, and we see the same for in-flight. It's really been able to target users that they, or audiences they wouldn't ordinarily be able to do.
Brilliant. I think on that note, we've run out of time, but that was really fascinating. Thank you very much for coming in, Ryan.
No, thank you for
Great
having me. It's been
you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Kieran, thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Mad Tech Podcast. See you next time.